In December 2022, members of the Australian Catholic Historical Society gathered at Mary MacKillop Place, North Sydney, first to celebrate the Society's annual Mass, where Monsignor Tony Doherty reminded members of the importance of conversation, storytelling and sharing of meals in the life and ministry of Jesus. Then we enjoyed a well-organised and well-catered Christmas luncheon, where the speaker was Dr. Anne Terming. Here is Anne, introduced by the Society's president, Dr. John Carmody.
Ladies and gentlemen, we now come to the part of the program which causes great relaxation and enjoyment to most of you and great tension to one of you. Anne is a member of the Society and a former member of the Council and a very, very clear-minded member of the Council and very willing to take on duties. But about this time last year, she graduated with a PhD in history from the University of Sydney. She had given a talk to the Society some years earlier on the subject of her thesis, which was Paddy Moran, the famous doctor and surgeon and rugby player, Herbert Michael Moran. But I decided that I didn't want anything as serious as an exposition on her work of the thesis. But I thought that it would be very interesting to hear from somebody. I hesitate to say, I don't know quite what you're allowed to say in these days, when sort of mature years or mid-career, but most PhDs are people who come straight out of their bachelor's degree with honours and sometimes do a master's or sometimes go straight into a PhD. They're usually very wet behind the ears and they don't know much about how the world works. Anne was not in that category, and she might have been a challenge. I've never discussed this with Julia Horne, her supervisor. She may well have been a challenge to her supervisor. And it's interesting, that use of words. We talk about, in a somewhat censorious Anglophone way, we talk about PhD supervisors. In Germany, they have a different word. I don't know how it's changed with these modern days of feminism, Germans have actually discovered that yet. But they talk about a Dr. Vater, a Dr. Parent. And there's a world of a difference between all the implications that the word parent has as compared with supervisor. And it seems to me it's far more censorious. And a lot of PhD supervisors get used to the idea of their students will be coming straight out of their courses and they won't know very much and they can push them around. And sometimes I wonder whether it's a bit of a shock to get somebody who actually knows a thing or two about the world and how it works to come and do a PhD. And in that case, you need a parent rather than a supervisor. Anyway, I suggested to Anne that she talk to us a little bit along those lines about what it was like. What was the experience of coming back some years after doing your first degree to do a PhD? What was the experience like in doing a PhD? Of course, I'm totally non-directive in these matters, and what the people say, despite the reputation that I may have, what people say is often as big a surprise to me as it might be to them when they come and actually decide to give a talk. And we'll have a look at what they've agreed to talk about and say, I don't really want to talk about that, I want to talk about something else. But anyway, I've asked Anne to come along and give us an idea, give us a feeling for what it's like to come back into academia to do a doctorate some years after you thought you'd shaken the dust of the place off your shoes. So welcome, Anne.
Thank you very much, Jack. Look, it's just lovely to be here, and thank you all so much for coming along and enjoying the food and Mass, of course, and listening to me, and let's see what we can make of this. First of all, I'd like to just get a hands up for anyone that's had a chance to look at the photographs that are on the table.
Also now on the ACHS website, beside the link to this talk.
And keep your hand up if you recognise any of the people in the photographs. Brilliant. Fantastic. That's good. We're on a good leak here. Okay. Yes, I've chosen my own way, John, not necessarily the way you had anticipated that this go. But just connecting with the original theme, which was Message from the Grave, I would have to say somewhat tongue-in-cheek, that writing a biography, which is what I did, is a grave business, a very grave business. And three graves in particular have informed the work that I've done, which was basically an historical biography of Herbert Morin. And perhaps some of you are thinking, well, what's the difference between a biography and an historical biography? That, I hope, will come out in my talk. The first two graves that I'd like to talk about is, the first of the three, is Herbert Morin's own grave, which is in Cambridge in England, where he died in 1946. His wife, Eva, died in 1975 here in Sydney, and hers is at Waverley Cemetery. Both are neglected. Morin's 1945 one is overgrown. Actually, it does say 46. It's 45 he died. It's overgrown with a very invasive ivy, and Eva's is just hidden under a bunch of very fertile weeds. And we know that's quite a common thing, of course. But his is very much a testament to his medical life in Australia. And the inscription on his grave describes him as Surgeon of Sydney. And readers, of course, being a Catholic grave, not a cemetery, were asked to pray for the repose of his soul. But there are no other real references on that tombstone. There's nothing about his parents, his wife, his child, his life in Australia as a famed rugby player, or that he served in World War I and World War II with Britain's Royal Army Medical Corps. And normally graves at that time would carry that sort of insignia. Eva's epitaph is very simple. It just has her full name, Eva Everill Augusta Morin, and the day that she died. So the link between the two is quite clear. But what is interesting is that the distance between those two graves, because really they're actually indicators of their lives, that they had very distant married lives. The third grave that I'd like to talk about is that of my father. And his is very well looked after, thanks to my sister Helen, who is here today. Dad took his own knowledge of Morin to the grave. But I'm sure if it were possible today to actually ask him about Morin, whom he undoubtedly knew, he would say something like, he was an interesting cove. And that's it. So, what drew me to this interesting cove and his history? Well, Dad, as Helen and I know, was a small-town GP and an avid reader. He had Morin's three books in his library, although library is probably a little bit grandiose because it was just a solitary bookshelf that I'm referring to in the corner of the hallway outside of his home consulting room where he saw patients after hours. So he was also a nephew of Morin by marriage. So Morin was a doctor, as many members of the family were, and he had a great passion for cancer treatment and prevention. And as I mentioned before, he was a keen rugby player and was in both world wars. But he was also captivated by the changes that Mussolini implemented to improve Italy, and he wrote about each of these in his published works. But the works, although they were reflections and people have tended to think of them as biographies, they were really just observations on life. So Morin was in this incredible position that he was writing about life in interwar Australia and his observations of it in a way that no one else had really done. The other reason why I undertook this Morin research was about 15 years ago when, on a cold winter's morning, when I was working at Macquarie University, I found myself in a really uninspiring staff meeting. And I thought, I need a retirement project. So I decided to read Morin's three books, and I absolutely found them fascinating. And decided thereafter that they would be my he would be my retirement project. And my husband to this day, who is also here, is incredibly grateful that I have another retirement project. Not him. It took me many years and a few degrees to get to the point where I could actually start investigating Morin in my doctoral thesis. But once I started, it was just all systems go. I love the topic. I had the time to do it as a mid to late career project, And I had the incredible support of people around me, such as my family, and also people here in this room to keep me on track. I knew what I was in for, and it just felt the right time in my life to do the degree. Now, people hear of doctoral and master's degrees, and there are some people in the room that know a lot about them as supervisors of those degrees. But for those that don't, those degrees are actually funded fully by the Australian government. So I have you, current and past taxpayers of Australia, to thank for the incredible privilege that I had of being able to do that degree. So students these days are just given 3 to 3.5 years to complete them. So, you know, it's all go from the moment you start. But each year in Australia, around 9,000 people actually attain those degrees. So it's a pretty good number. But the start, as we know, is often the hardest part. And I really did find it difficult to work out what to write about Maureen, given the complexity that that person was, and how to really engage with the historical events that surrounded him. Because he was living in a really complex social and political environment in the 1920s and 30s in Australia and around the world. There was a lot of change, and he, in his own small way, was part of some of those elements of that change. But I needed to be able to say, well, what was happening and how did his reaction inform the things that were, you know, his response to the things that were going on around him. So that's kind of where I started. And Macquarie University, where I worked and was a student for many years, was a great place to build my underpinning information about historiography. But the move to Sydney University absolutely made sense. Because Maureen trained, like all doctors at the time who trained in New South Wales and some from other states as well, they trained at Sydney University. And he was also, through his rugby career, a member of its rugby club for as long as he was in Australia, up to about 1935. So it just made sense. And the archives at Sydney Uni are just a fabulous source of information about its past students and also the things that happened at that time. Right now, for the remainder of the talk, just to spend a little bit of time on archives and images, because they're the two things that really sort of made this PhD journey a really interesting one for me. Now, Maureen was a fellow of St John's College at the University of Sydney, and he was a great mate of Father Maurice O'Reilly. For those of you who have read Viewless Winds, and there are a couple here, Maureen wrote about the time when Maurice O'Reilly invited Maureen to attend the Irish Peace Conference, which was held in Paris in 1922. But he invited him to attend as a representative of Tasmania. Now, Maureen had never been to Tasmania, but it turns out that the Irish diaspora from around the world were invited to attend this great conference, which was really about joining the Irish diaspora in their fight against the British in Ireland. By the time it gathered together, peace had been declared in Ireland. So it turned its attentions to really the Gaelic revival and extending the Irish influence everywhere. Well, everywhere where the Irish were. It was an incredible event, and I sort of thought, well, what's really going on here? But it's actually quite difficult to source. But fortunately, I was able to get some information from the Irish archives in Dublin and also from St Mary's Library, I think it's called, at Newman College in Melbourne, who has a full transcript of the proceedings from that Congress. So it was interesting to read all of that, and there's a lot more that can be said and I won't say it now. But the absolute high point of that was to get a copy of that photograph, the group photograph, the large number of people that attended that conference. So Maurice O'Reilly was there, and the rest of the people, aside from only some of the international people, comprised the people that basically fought in the Irish Civil War against each other. Half of the audience had accepted the Irish Peace Treaty, and half hadn't, and there they were, and there was a lot of behind-the-scenes paraphernalia trying to sort out what would happen next. So we've got Maurice O'Reilly there. My mate, Herbert Moran, is there somewhere. Does anyone know where he was? Probably not. It's a very small picture. He's right in the back row. He's the only one with glasses. You got it? In the front row, we've got some pretty impressive people. And you did get De Valera. He's in the front row, a very young De Valera. There's also Maurice O'Reilly there in the front row. There's also Mary McSweeney and Countess Markievicz. Countess Markievicz is the one who's best known for posing with her rifle in some of the PR material that was put out around the world. So some people got some of those names. If you know of any other names, I'd love to hear them because there are a lot of people I can't recognise. He's the only one with glasses and he's on the right-hand side, top right. Only one with glasses. Oh, two. Beg your pardon. Back row. I need glasses. One, two, three, four. Fifth from the right. This was taken in Paris, 1922, where they gathered. It was considered fitting that they gathered in Paris because that's where the peace conference was after the end of World War One. Okay, we're going to move on now. We're going to move internationally to Italy. So in the 1920s and 30s, Moran was infatuated with Italy. And as we know, Italy, of course, through the Vatican and the church representatives, was important for Australian Catholic life, as were the ties with Ireland. The significant thing that happened in 1929, as most people with a familiarity of church history will know, was the signing of the Lateran Treaty. And the Lateran Treaty was a means for the Vatican City to attain and retain, I think I'm correct in that, its independent status as a nation with its own jurisdictional responsibilities at a time when it was geographically and physically surrounded by fascism. And there's a lot that, of course, we know about that, but one of the treasures I came across was this other photograph, which was in the Catholic press. And it really made me sit up. So I'm hoping that we've got some other people in the room that will recognise some of those in the photograph with the four gentlemen in regalia. Any ideas? Excellent. Very good. Very good indeed. You probably would not know the others. So it was published in the 10th of October, just 4 months after the treaty was signed, 1929. 10th of October, 4 months after the treaty was signed. So what happened? Because the Vatican had its own national status, jurisdictional status, as did Italy, there were protocols that were exchanged. So people visited each other and celebrated the signing of the treaty. And that's what's actually happening here in this photograph. And part of that was, it was a necessity, I suppose. But remember also at the time that Australia did not have embassies. Australia was represented by Britain because the Westminster Treaty had not been implemented at that point. It was after that that Australia could have its own embassies. So the visit was really the local Italian representatives visiting the apostolic delegate, who was the official representative of the church here. So that was the international component there. And Gilroy, at that point, was assistant to the delegate. So what I'm going to read out is actually what the newspaper said about that. The acting consul general for Italy, and that's Mario Carosi, and the apostolic delegate to Australasia, who was Archbishop Cataneo at the time, exchange visits as a result of the signing of the Lateran Treaty, which resolved the Roman question. In the morning, the consul general, wearing uniform, was attended by the vice consul, Signor Vitali, called on his excellency the apostolic delegate, who in full robes received his visitors at his residence in North Sydney. The Reverend Dr. Gilroy, secretary to the apostolic delegation, was in attendance. At that time, when I found this photograph, I was working at the Australian Catholic University in Edward Street, North Sydney, and my office was in the building which was the backdrop to this recognition of the signing of the treaty. So I was absolutely thrilled when I saw this. I'd read John Lutterell's book, of course, about... No, actually, I read it afterwards, actually. I came across the photograph. A real find. And so it was a thrill to actually see him, recognise him, and to just feel so at home with those balustrades. There you go. That's just a little pleasure for me. So just one more article that I came across, which was in a very obscure 1930s newspaper called the Italian Bulletin of Commerce. Wow, you know, why would you read that? But in it is the most fascinating article that Herbert Morin wrote about his visit with Benito Mussolini, his first visit when he went. He'd been to Italy before, but friends had actually lined up a visit with Mussolini, and Mussolini was very open to all sorts of international visitors. And Herbert wrote, or Morin as I call him, wrote quite a lot about him. They met in, as I said, 1932. It was in the Palazzo Venezia, which is kind of, you know, some people may have seen it, but these days, because it was Mussolini's official place, it really isn't on the tourist radar very much at all. It's not something that is necessarily of great pride, I guess. And they met in a room called La Sala del Mappamondo, which is basically the room of the world globe, I think it was. And I'll just very briefly read what Morin said about that. He said fascinating things about that actual visit, but this one thing, these couple of sentences really got me. I was shown through a small door, then diagonally opposite me, in the distance, I perceived a desk, and upon it a globe-shaped lamp. Behind this one could detect the figure of a man who wrote. I saluted in Roman style, and he immediately stood up and returned the salute. When I reached his desk, his first greeting put me at ease. His voice was soft, and his manner that of a kindly physician. My goodness, this is him meeting Mussolini, saluting in the Roman salute. You know, it's a bit of a worry, really. But what that, as good historians I soon learnt, were supposed to do is find out the background to all of this. What's going on? Not so much the building, but even simple things like, well, what's the significance of this Roman salute? The Roman salute, which I think was a bit like, you know, the straight arm salute, was used quite a lot in different locations around the world, not just for fascist or communist or whatever other reason. It had just become almost commonplace, and it sounds terrible to us now when we hear about that. And of course, one of the things that also changed was Mussolini's demeanour. In 1932, he was a very different man to some 7 or 8 years later. No excuses, though. So I just was so captivated by this, and then 18 months later I found myself walking into the Palazzo Venezia, walking up the 70 stairs that actually led to that room. And when Morin visited, he said it was completely empty except for just the table and a chair and Mussolini, and that's it. And it's still that way these days. There's nothing in there if people have visited it. What's interesting is it's had a slight rejigging of the decoration so that on the floor there's an emblem of the faces. The fascist faces has actually been put into the marble on the floor. But other than that, it's basically retains its historical significance. So that all added completely different dimensions to the way I wanted to write about Morin, because it really helped me not just discover more about him and what he did, but what was this actually saying about Australia, and particularly Australia in that interwar period. And one of the, for me it was a really surprising find, is just how amenable middle-class Sydney was to Italian fascism. It's a very different form of fascism to the one that we're more familiar with Hitler, but there was an incredible propaganda machinery that ran very successfully and very deliberately around the world, which was about restoring Rome to its previous grandeur. There was nothing to be concerned about here. We're all about making life better for everyone. And up to a point, it succeeded. So that's just all one part of Moran's life, but fundamentally he was a doctor and he was a really deeply committed cancer surgeon and held numerous appointments as a radium specialist. When I say appointments, he was on on the staff of about four or five hospitals at once because of his radium credentials. But not a lot was known about radium at the time. Some people knew it was dangerous up to a point. And I think it was quite some later before Marie Curie even realised just how dangerous it was. But Moran was so concerned that he put the radium that he was using in his patients, he put it in a lead container and carried it around in his pocket, thinking, oh, it's safe that way in the lead, which it wasn't. But it has its own history, radium. So in all, Moran published something like 25 medical articles, and I really needed, for the thesis, found myself having to go into all of his publications. There were 69 in all. There were medical articles, books, pamphlets, some published letters. A very kind, and I'm putting inverted commas around the word kind, historian by the name of Anthy Hislop said, you can't write something like that without an annotated bibliography. And I thought, oh, crumbs, I just can't do this. Luckily, it took me about 3 months to do over sort of a lapsed time period, but I'll never think of Christmas and New Year again without thinking of doing an annotated bibliography, let me tell you. But it was valuable because it just showed me a little bit about how Moran progressed professionally, socially, historically, contextually, all that sort of stuff. So the thesis taught me a lot of things, and I certainly owe much to my supervisor, as John has already mentioned, Julia Horn. But we never stop learning, do we? And even now I've started looking at other elements of Moran's life, including the graves of his family and his wife's family, and that comes up with a whole lot of different elements as well. But just to summarise, it's taken me sort of 15 or 16 years to get to this point. So what have I learnt about him? Well, I suppose just to capture some of the words of our homily, that Moran was a great storyteller, and he was an historian because he was a great storyteller, and he's contributed much to our interwar knowledge of Australian, a knowledge of interwar Australian history because of those books that he published. Religiously, he had a strong belief in God, perhaps not a regular attendee, but his belief in that, for a number of reasons, was far stronger than his commitment to the Sydney Catholic Church because he was constantly at odds with it. Ireland deeply influenced him. But like his father, when his father came to Australia and his family afterwards, they put that behind them. They just wanted to be first and foremost Australians. And for me, that's part of that whole federation thing that was happening at that time. We are Australian. We can stand on our own two feet. We need to make our own way. And those migrants really wanted to be part of that. But Moran was totally alarmed by the shenanigans that went on at that Irish peace conference in 1922. And after that, he turned his back on Ireland, not interested. As I've suggested, he, like many others, thought Mussolini was the answer to Italy's woes. And he really defended it against the sanctions and the criticisms by the League of Nations after Italy invaded Ethiopia. So he was very naive, our friend Moran. But once World War II started, he got back onto what I consider to be a reasonable right path and went back to England and signed up to serve in World War II against the others. He cared deeply about his patients, and their suffering haunted him throughout his life. And in the end, I think it was his memory of their suffering that actually helped him through with his own cancer journey when he died in 1945. Tom McNamara, whom I don't know and haven't been able to trace, and if anyone here knows much about him, I'd love to hear, wrote quite a moving article about Moran's own death, believing that he'd died a holy death. That was interesting. These days, we'd probably say that Moran, and I'm saying these days, Moran was probably neither a good father nor a good husband. But in the end, both his wife and son tended to him when he was dying in those final months. At the end, fundamentally, he was a type of post-Federation man, and I believe that his star really did shine quite brightly, but it was a very brief illumination. Thank you. Happy to take any questions.
Thank you very much, Anne. I've been an admirer of Moran for a long time, ever since I read his three books. The first of them, which Anne mentioned, In My Fashion. Viewless Winds. In My Fashion comes later. It's the last of them. Viewless Winds was the first one. I remember Sol Ensel, the Foundation Professor of Sociology at the University of Sydney, saying to me that that was the finest book that had ever been written about Australian society. No wonder I can see why the church authorities hated him. And his descriptions of life in St. Vincent's and Dr. Morris McCarthy, the surgeon and musician and so on, were really quite remarkable. Then the second one was all about his time in Europe. When he went, that was Beyond the Hills Lies China. And the last of them was put together, I think is one of the glories of Australian literature, and unrecognised, all of them are, but the last one in particular, because as Anne mentioned at the very end, this man who had devoted his life to the introduction of radiotherapy in Australia and treatment of cancer died of a most horrible death of melanoma, which he diagnosed himself when he was working in Oxford in the British Medical Service. And he went to see one of his colleagues to have the diagnosis confirmed and then underwent the surgery. And it is the most poetic, the last third of that book. It's very hard to write, think about it without tears. But it's one of the greatest examples of Australian literature. And it's not recognised because it's this man contemplating his own death. And it was his son Patrick, the Foundation Professor of Statistics at the ANU, who put it together through the press. So,
I think, John, that's part of what appealed to Tom McNamara when he wrote his piece. It was just that very sort of emotional way that he dealt with his own death. And it was a real sort of redemption tale. Because he recalled all of the things that I have done in my life that I wish I hadn't done. I was a bully. I wish I hadn't have been a bully. And there's a lot of forgiveness in it. It's really lovely to read, yes.
The other thing to remember at this time of obsessional focus on football is that Moran went to England in 1908 with the first rugby union team ever to tour. And they were called the Wallabies, not by their own choice, but by the English press, who initially wanted to call them the Bunnies, and they didn't like that idea. He was the captain of the Australian rugby team, and there's a wonderful story told about him. I'm paraphrasing this a little. But he went to school. His father had a pastry cook's bakery in City Road at Chippendale. And he went to school at the Darlington Public School, which still stands, thanks to the efforts of Peter Platt. And when he started playing football, he was living in Rushcutters Bay, and he played with Rushcutters Bay. And Souths were notorious. And there was that in the team that they played against, one particular weekend, there was a footballer, I've forgotten his name now, it may have been Jimmy, who would kick, was notorious for kicking heads in scrums if they weren't in the right place. And after the game, Paddy said to his brother, "I thought I was going to get kicked in the head, and then this boot stopped coming." Oh yes, said Jimmy. Said his brother, "That was Jimmy." He said, "I used to sit next to Paddy at Darlington School. You can't kick a bloke that you were at school with in the same class and shared the same form." And Moran said something to the effect, I'm paraphrasing him, but he said, "It's true what they say in Sydney, it does depend on what school you went to." So has anyone got any questions or comments? Please, can you come up here so that we can get it on the recording?
While we're just waiting for that, you'll get here. one of the he wrote some very negative things about his and very subjective experiences with Catholic hospitals and some of the Catholic clergy. He was not a friend of Michael Kelly at all, but he was a friend of Bert Evetts, you know, H.V. Evetts, and went during, in 1942, I think it was, they were having lunch in London, and Bert apparently said to him that he was mates with the head of Angus and Robertson, and the head of Angus and Robertson, who was selling Moran's book, Viewless Winds, said that the nuns used to come in with cash to buy the book, ask for it to be wrapped in plain paper, and they would pay cash for it because they didn't want to appear on the bills, because Catholics wanted to read his book, even though the church, and particularly Gilroy at the time, but it was led by Catholic doctors, really were very, very dark about Moran and what he wrote at that time.
Thank you, Anne. Marvellous talk. We've all been in raptures, I'm sure. Well, speaking for myself. I'm speaking as one of those latter age PhD graduates. I think probably I was older than you when I started. But it was pre-Trove days. And look, Trove has made the historian's job so much easier. And I noticed that Anne really didn't say very much about working in archives. I think she just glossed over that bit. because before Trove, so I'm talking about, 20 years ago now, my God. You had to go into a library, and the newspapers had to be read on a terrible machine that you battle with, and if you wanted to read the Catholic Weekly, that was, that was made very difficult for you. A really awful and probably expensive process as well to read through newspaper articles about whatever your subject was. So that's what I wanted to say. I think now Trove has made history available to everyone, and they also have made PhD theses a lot shorter.
More manageable.
That's really what I'm trying to say. I think mine was about 120,000 words, and I think you only have to keep it to about 100,000 now. So they've made things are a lot easier for historians to get a PhD thesis. And but I was interested what you said about the difference between being, I think John might have said that, about being, wet behind the ears and straight out of undergraduate work into working with a supervisor, compared to someone who was 60 years old working with someone who had actually been her teacher in secondary school. That was me. Very, very different. Sorry for being boring. I've had too much wine.
Thank you, Janice. It may have made theses easier, but it's made theses and books much better because you can get much more comprehensive access to the resources, and so that's all to the good. For those who don't know, Trove is a great collaborative venture, digitising collaboration between, driven by the ANU, the National Library of Australia, rather, and involving every state library and others in Australia to digitise every newspaper published in Australia. And it is just extraordinary. It's sometimes a bit difficult and frustrating to use when you forget what to do. But the other thing that it tells us is how important newspapers were in the early life of the colony. And every little town had its own newspaper, local, particularly Catholic newspapers, but the newspapers in Singleton and Cessnock, and they all had their newspapers, and they all copied stuff from the major metropolitan papers, and you'd see things in the London papers that said, "Colonial papers, please copy," which they were pleased to do. But it is an extraordinary venture, And anyone who hasn't used it, I recommend just go home and type Trove into your Google search, and the riches of this resource will be only too apparent. Jared, would you like to come up here? It's only for the recording, you understand, and so that people here can hear you.
Just thanks very much, and that was terrific. I mean, I'm going to go home and pull down my copy of Euless Winds and put it on the bedside table for Christmas. Reread, mind you. Just apropos of your story about the nuns coming in to buy the books, that brings up the matter of legends and all the rest of it, which no doubt as a historian, your job is to sift the legend from the reality. But Father Charles Fraser of the Society of Jesus once told me that the Countess Freehill, no less, had bought up or tried to buy up all available copies of Euless Winds in order to burn them. Well, it's a very common second-hand book, so obviously she was not successful, if there's any truth in that at all. And I'd also be interested to hear about correspondence. What, especially presumably as his wife and himself were apart a lot of the time, what correspondence, personal correspondence above all, is there?
Thank you, Jared. Yes, that's the Countess Freehill story is a good one, and that's the reason why the book actually went to four print runs, because the first one sort of sold out. But we're not actually 100% sure that she was the person, because within that book too, there's a lot of discussion about the University of Sydney Cancer Research Committee. And that was a particularly difficult situation that occurred, where the people of New South Wales put in lots of money to help the fight against cancer. A committee at the University of Sydney was established to actually judiciously and carefully spend that money, but a lot of the money was actually spent on scientific research, which was almost at that stage not irrelevant, but it didn't actually help the cancer fight. And Moran wanted that money spent on public health promotion of cancer as a disease, and what people needed to be aware of to monitor their bodies and look for early signs, because most people who had cancer were going to the doctor when it was far too late to do anything about it. So, yes, it's a great story, and I think there's about 50% chance that one was right. Well, maybe more. And let's make it 95, because it is a great story. So, correspondence, very little that I could find between Eva and his wife. What the family kept was the correspondence between Maureen's son and he, and they've got that in their own family archive in Canberra, and that's been incredibly useful because it actually shows Maureen as a father, and it's quite a different view to this other Maureen, the rugby champion and all that sort of stuff that we read about. Also, the State Library has got some letters that Maureen wrote to a number of his friends. The Evatt letters aren't there, apparently, but there's some to Molesworth, who was a great friend, and a couple of other medical doctors. And you can sort of, if you really wanted to, go through those at the State Library, but they're also available in microfiche, I think, as well. And they just help build up the picture of the man as a person rather than the man as on a pedestal and a hero, which is really what we all need, isn't it, just to be normal people, to show our normal selves. Thanks, Terry.
I think Sol Ensel told me the same story, so doesn't mean it's true that it's come from two women forces, but it's a great story, and if it isn't true, it should be. Okay, well, if there's no more question or discussion, we'll leave it for people to congratulate Anne later, but I think that Anne deserves credit, not just for the thesis achievement, but for the way she went about it, and it was fascinating to hear that today. Thank you very much indeed. Have a happy Christmas and a safe one. But it's been a great year for the Society despite the difficulties, and it's ended in a wonderful way. It's great to be back here and to be in these newly made elegant rooms. So thank you all for coming, and thank you all for the support that you give the Society, and long may we prosper.
We've been listening to Dr. Anne Terming relate her experience of undertaking doctoral studies on Herbert Michael Moran as a mid to late career project. The Q&A which followed was moderated by Dr. John Carmody, President of the Australian Catholic Historical Society. It took place on Saturday, the 10th of December 2022 at Mary MacKillop Place, North Sydney, Australia. This ACHS podcast was recorded and produced by me, John Kenny, on the traditional lands of the Cammeraygal and Wallumedegal peoples of the Eora Nation. The Society acknowledges the prior ownership of Australia by its Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples, ownership that was never ceded to colonists. Our program of history talks will resume in the crypt of St Patrick's, Churchill, on the afternoon of Sunday, the 19th of February 2023, and we hope that you can join us there in the new year after a peaceful and holy Christmas. Bye for now.